Now we have Andrew King from La Jolla, California, and you can see that since he's from California, he's not fazed at all by all the stuff he had to go through to get the computer to work. But we are going to talk about a very important issue, and that's blood volume, dry weight, and blood pressure control, which certainly we know can influence outcomes in our patients, and probably we don't have a good definition of how to achieve these in hemodialysis. So it was well worth the wait.
Thank you, John. Andrew. And I was just recently moved to La Jolla from Boston, and so I guess I am a little fazed by this this problem with computers. It does make me want to go back to plain old slides, but I also have made the elected to not use color and images that move, etc. I'm going to talk about blood volume, dry weight, and blood pressure control, a problem that we need to be dealing with more effectively, given its important ramifications. I'm going to start with a little epidemiology, talk about the pathogenesis of hypertension, and then dwell for a little while on this concept of dry weight, and then end up by talking about hypotension on dialysis. Well, what's the problem is that we have interdialytic blood pressure, or systemic hypertension, that needs to be balanced with problems with intradialytic blood pressure. And the dry weight is where we achieve a normal blood pressure without having people crash. And we're not doing a very good job on this side, and certainly people are crashing a lot, in part because we're doing dialysis a whole lot faster. So, having said that, I wanted to point out that the patients who come to our dialysis unit are not in the best shape with regard to blood pressure. In this data from the NHANES 3, in people with creatinines of 1.4 to 1.6, note that 70% are hypertensive and most of them are on antihypertensives, but depending on what definition in the JNC6 you want to use, the vast majority are not appropriately controlled, with a mean blood pressure of 147 over 77, not the greatest. And indeed, as GFR goes down, the percent hypertensive goes up, and here's the patient who starts dialysis. So they come to us with hypertension, virtually all of them. Now, we know that on dialysis, these patients have already suffered many of the complications of hypertension, so that our patients who are receiving renal replacement therapy, hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis, their prevalence of coronary artery disease is substantially higher than the general population, and indeed, as we've heard before, left ventricular hypertrophy is rampant. Prior to starting, upon initiation, 40%, later, 70%. Terrible. Well, how about hypertension within our dialysis population? Well, we know that 50 to 90% have a blood pressure that exceeds 140 over 90 millimeters mercury. We know that this hypertension is bad. It promotes left ventricular hypertrophy, and we believe that that is in part due to loss of a nocturnal dip in blood pressure, just overall poor control of blood pressure. And indeed, Foley, in a very nice analysis, found that an increase in blood pressure of 10 millimeters mercury correlated with left ventricular hypertrophy, de novo CHF, de novo ischemic heart disease. That is not pre-existing. However, the association of blood pressure to mortality is inconsistent. Well, let's look and see why that is. You know, in the general population, we talk about the J-shaped curve and the possibility of whether it is. This is the mortality versus systolic blood pressure in our patients. And of course, it's not a J-shaped curve, it's a U-shaped curve. In California, this would be called a half pipe. and you'd be skateboarding back and forth. But the bottom line is, when you look at those patients in your dialysis unit who have a very low systolic blood pressure, those patients are probably at the end of the road of their cardiac disease. In other words, their left ventricular hypertrophy is dilated out, and they're starting to have low systolic function. So that's why when you can see that if you try to correlate blood pressure to mortality, you're going to have two different populations. Nevertheless, even at the top range, you do start to see the range that you would sort of have predicted. Now, controversy remains over what blood pressure we should be assessing. Should we be assessing the pre-dialysis, post-dialysis, an average of the two? Should we be incorporating home blood pressure monitoring? How about ambulatory blood pressure monitoring? Well, the short answer is that we do not have very much of an answer. We don't have the answer to that question. But we do know that roughly the average of the pre and the post correlates fairly well with ambulatory blood pressure monitoring. What should our goal be? We certainly don't have that answer. And so, at least for now, we go for the JNC6 type goal of 130 to 135 over 85. What is the antihypertensive of choice? Again, a very important question that is being addressed, but we don't have the answers as of now. I thought I'd just put in one ambulatory blood pressure monitoring tracing. And this is a 48-hour, so this is between two dialysis sessions. And you can see that during the dialysis, the systolic and the diastolic blood pressure dropped. It stayed pretty much the same, and over the dialysis interval, there was a slow increase in blood pressure. And this is more or less the typical pattern, but the typical, of course, doesn't mean everybody. What's interesting is the shaded versions are nighttime, and you can see that although on the first day post-dialysis, you had a little nocturnal dip in blood pressure, on the second night between dialysis sessions, this was not evident. So now I'm going to talk about pathogenesis for a few minutes. First off, we of course know blood pressure relates to cardiac output and SVR. And in the hypertension of end-stage renal disease, clearly there's no question that this is dominated by an increase in systemic vascular resistance, with much lesser effects on cardiac output. Even though one would think these are volume-expanded patients and consequently you'd think cardiac output was increased. But indeed, that's not the case. And if you compare dialysis patients who are hypertensive versus normotensive, their cardiac indices are similar. And if you assess this and you blood pressure and both blood pressure and SVR are normalized by either bilateral nephrectomy or ultrafiltration, suggesting that there's an important relationship of SVR to plasma volume. Well, as you know, however, it is clear that the hypertensive dialysis patient compared to the normotensive dialysis patient has an increase in total body water. These patients are expanded. And yet, the volume expansion may not be the whole story. We do know that the sympathetic nervous system is increased. However, and we know for sure that plasma catecholamines means rise during dialysis. However, if you compare hypertensive and normotensives, you can't see any difference in the plasma levels. But sympathetic discharge in the peroneal nerve is roughly 2.5-fold higher in hemodialysis patients than normal. And this is normalized by bilateral nephrectomy, suggesting that possibly enhanced sympathetic nervous system tone from the dead kidney may contribute to the hypertension. We also know that other systems are clearly deranged in our dialysis patients, such as endothelium-dependent vasodilation. We know that hypertension alone impairs that, but uremia probably does too. We know that part of that story, of course, is nitric oxide production, and a natural factor ADMA, asymmetric dimethyl arginine, is actually quite elevated in our dialysis population. Nevertheless, everybody who does dialysis knows that normalizing the extracellular fluid volume is the mainstay of therapy and has been ever since Scribner's articles. And blood pressure usually drops on dialysis, and up to 80%, although I'm not so sure I believe that anymore, can be controlled by ultrafiltration alone. And this brings us to the question of dry weight. Well, dry weight, you'll know it when you see it. I don't think so, unless you have better vision than I do. There are a number of definitions, and I'm going to read two or three that have sort of stuck. That is, dry weight is not merely the absence of edema, but that body sodium content and volume of body water or critical component thereof below which further reduction results in hypotension, period. That's got to be from England. Another definition is volume removal to correct clinical fluid overload and optimize seated blood pressure without symptomatic orthostatic hypotension after dialysis. And finally, dry weight is that body weight at the end of dialysis at which the patient can remain normotensive until the next dialysis without antihypertensive medication. So slight variations on the same theme. Now, how do we assess dry weight? Well, of course, we've heard in the last decade or so of ASNs, very, you know, a number of papers regarding bioimpedance, ultrasound in the inferior vena cava, AMP levels, various assessments of blood volume. The truth of it is, in a dialysis unit that you and I go through every day, gestalt plays a lot, big role in it, and indeed trial and error. So these other things just are not they're not sufficiently sensitive to be incorporated in the routine dialysis. Now, of course, our patients are never in the steady state, right? They are never. And of course, the unsteadiest state is during dialysis, and the most unsteady state is on Sunday night. And yet, here's the principle, of course, is that they gain weight between dialysis, and this is the dry weight. Now, before I move on to more sophisticated aspects of this talk, we know that over time, that dry weight can migrate. Particularly, for instance, in the first 6 months of dialysis, when that very uremic patient who was malnourished is finally starting to eat again, and they're actually gaining lean body mass. In this circumstance, the dry weight goes up somewhat, and so dialysis and ultrafiltration takes these patients below the dry weight, and they become hypotensive. By contrast, and unfortunately more frequently, a patient who has a chronic illness or just not doing well on dialysis loses lean body mass, and suddenly your end of dialysis weight is above the dry weight, and on, of course, Sunday night or Monday night, the two worst nights to be on, they present to the emergency room with congestive heart failure, and everybody says, do they have a heart attack, da-da-da-da-da, et cetera, but really they're just volume overload and they need to have some extra ultrafiltration. So on that night, you can take a cab to the emergency room and dialyze them. So what is the relationship of volume status to blood pressure during hemodialysis? Well, we're starting to reap some of the benefits of this HEMO trial, and I thought I'd share a few of them, some of the preliminary data. In this manuscript, what they did was a cross-sectional study of a subset of these the patients who are participating in this study. 62% were African American, roughly 40% diabetic. Most were on antihypertensives. They assessed plasma volume by measuring pre and post protein concentrations using the increase as an index of how much the plasma volume increased. A couple things that are noteworthy. Pre-dialysis, their blood pressure was 152 over 82. And these are in, theoretically, very good units. And it just goes to show you that I don't think we're doing the greatest job of treating hypertension in that dialysis unit. Whereas their post was 137 over 74. The average weight gain was 3 kilos, and the average plasma volume goes down by about 10% during dialysis. Now, if you look at the intradialytic weight loss, essentially the weight gain between dialysis, you can think of it that way, and it correlates with the pre-dialysis systolic blood pressure. Okay, so people who gain a lot of weight between dialysis sessions are more likely to have a high pre-dialysis blood pressure. By contrast, post-dialysis, the best predictor of the post-dialysis blood pressure was the change in the plasma volume. Those who had a very relatively small change in plasma volume had higher post-dialysis blood pressures, whereas those who had a more robust decrease clearly had an improvement. And it suggests that these patients still have volume on board to be removed. One of the facts that came out of this was that for every kilogram removed, the average blood pressure reduction was about 3 millimeters mercury. Okay, the problem, of course, is we are all too much in a hurry. We as physicians are in too much of a hurry, but our patients clearly are in a hurry, and we have a job. We have to remove 1 to 2 times the whole plasma volume over a very short period of time. And, of course, achieving the dry weight is hindered primarily by hypotension. This complicates mostly about 10 to 30%, but if you take specialized populations, such as diabetics, older persons, it can be up to 50% of treatments in these subgroups. And, of course, this is a frequent cause of termination, as is cramps, another manifestation of overly rapid ultrafiltration occurring in quite a few patients. Both of these can also interfere with our ability to deliver adequate amounts of dialysis. Well, what are the consequences? You know, we have a pretty good feel for what the consequences of hypertension out of control is, left ventricular hypertrophy, stroke, etc. But what are the consequences of somebody going into Trendelenburg two or three times a week? This we have much less of an appreciation for. And we sort of have this gestalt that there's, back to gestalt, that there's an increase in morbidity and possibly mortality associated with this. And the problem is we don't sort of consistently monitor how often these patients, how often or how severe patients have their hypotensive episodes. However, we know that in diabetic patients who have 2 to 3 episodes of hypotension per week, there was a threefold increased risk of death, right? These are probably patients at just great risk. And in some data that is an abstract, actually it's a talk, I believe, at this meeting, a prospective cohort of quite a few number of patients, 1,200 some patients, over 2 years, the risk was of the mortality was 0.72 for every 20 millimeters mercury reduction in the lowest blood pressure during dialysis. So it suggests that these patients do have problems. Now, of course, there's a lot of reasons that people during dialysis can have hypotension. I put at the top overly rapid ultrafiltration because it's by far my opinion and that of many others that this is numero uno. But also there's rapid change in plasma osmolality. Of course, these patients have cardiac disease. Organ ischemia with adenosine release, very interesting. Autonomic neuropathy, of course. You saw in the hemotrophy trial, 70-some percent were on antihypertensive agents. Low sodium bath, food ingestion, membrane reaction. I'm not going to touch the anemia question, though it has relevance to this whole issue, but it's too much. Well, first, we know that long, slow dialysis cures hypertension and protects against CVHD. Now, of course, everybody knows that in Tucson, when you have 8-hour dialysis sessions, that you have normal blood pressure at 6 months in about 98% of these patients. And furthermore, this translates into improved cardiovascular outcomes. And we have preliminary data to suggest that nocturnal dialysis or short daily dialysis is going to probably have some similar benefits with respect to blood pressure. And dare I mention it, peritoneal dialysis, another form of slow dialysis. Now, I'm not going to go into too much depth of how changes in osmolality affects plasma volume, but clearly what we're doing is that we're causing an abrupt drop in the osmolality of the extracellular fluid, therefore leading to a shift of water into the intracellular space. The only thing I would say is that, remember, hypotension is relatively uncommon when you don't have the ultrafiltration component. We see it, but not too often. Well, let's talk about that person who's crashing in the dialysis unit, who's going into Trendelenburg. What are their systemic hemodynamics? Well, if you assess their cardiac index, and here's 2 to 30 minutes before an episode, and here's during a hypotensive episode, you can see that you have an abrupt, substantial reduction in cardiac index. Blood volume was relatively unchanged, and total peripheral resistance was relatively unchanged. So it is an abrupt fall in cardiac output, not peripheral resistance, that is the dominant cause of hypotension. Since blood volume was not different, it suggests that cardiac filling was impaired, perhaps related to a change in venous capacity. Well, let's talk about cardiac filling. Cardiac filling is critical to prevent hypotension during dialysis. And this brings up the De Jager-Crow effect. Essentially, what this says is that, you know, the arterial and the venous side of the vasculature are indeed connected by tubes that are not blocked, hopefully, and some of the pressure within the arterial are transmitted into the venules, leading to some distension and venous pooling. And this is primarily in the splanchnic area and the skin. And that when you vasoconstrict, have a vasoconstrictor response, that this transmitted pressure is reduced, and consequently there is essentially a movement of fluid from that venous space back into the venules and up into the heart to refill. Now, you know, when these patients who are hypotension prone, you know, clearly the question arises, well, maybe they don't have a normal heart. Maybe they have a filling problem, or maybe they have a very poor heart. And I like this study because it did dobutamine echocardiography stress testing, in 18 patients who are hypotension prone, they fairly frequent hypotension, and 18 resistant patients. The first thing is that at baseline, there were no wall motion abnormality differences. Both of them had some, but they were relatively similar. Furthermore, the at-rest cardiac index was the same in these two populations. By contrast, when they were given dobutamine, the patients who are hypotension prone failed to increase their cardiac index very much, whereas those with resistance actually jumped their, almost doubled their cardiac index. So these persons who have that sudden hypotension are very likely to be those who have bad cardiac disease. Well, what about the sympathetic nervous system? Could this play a role in this sudden hypotension? Well, we know that in certain patients who are hypotension prone, you can have an abrupt loss in the sympathetic nervous system tone. And whether this is related to an ischemia-induced release of adenosine or something related to nitric oxide is unclear. But in this example, you can see that at baseline, your sympathetic tone, blood pressure, right? And then 5 minutes prior to the hypotensive episode, lots of sympathetic activity, right? And then during the hypotensive activity, drops substantially, and of course, blood pressure plummets. So the sympathetic nervous system will have a sudden sympathetic, well, sudden loss of sympathetic tone can contribute to that patient who seems like they're doing great, 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 I don't feel well, thud. So let's talk about some strategies to reduce hypotension. Well, first thing is you got to spend some time thinking about the dry weight. You have to figure out whether or not this patient's losing dry lean body mass or gaining it. Then the other strategy is to reduce the ultrafiltration rate. A lot of us sort of relinquish that dietary advice to our dietitians. I think we probably should take command of that, because not only will that lessen the tendency towards hypotension, but sodium restriction has to be one of our key elements for blood pressure control between dialysis sessions. And of course, we try to avoid thirst-provoking drugs. How about slow dialysis? Well, you could transfer the patient to Tisan. You could start nocturnal dialysis, or you can do frequent dialysis. But for most of us, these are not realistic solutions. Now, how about some of the newer strategies? I put new in quotes when I talk about sodium modeling, because of course we've all heard about it for many years. And with our new machines, it's so easy to do that it's, you know, it's become sort of routine. But I have a few comments to say about that. Cool dialysate also has been around for a while. And we have pharmacologic agents, one that we almost never pay attention to, even though the reports came out at least roughly a decade ago. And then a new agent, midodrine. And finally, I want to end up by talking about continuous blood volume monitoring. Let's talk sodium modeling for a second. Of course, theoretically, a higher sodium concentration will blunt the reduction in plasma osmolality, thereby lessen the movement of water into cells. And of course, various strategies have been employed, some using continuous high sodium, some modeling, either smooth decrease or step rise reduction from values as high as 155 down to 140. I'm just going to choose one study, okay, because there's so many. But I like this because it was a crossover blinded study of 23 patients over 2 weeks. And hypotension, this is not a hypotension prone group, and so it was a modest incidence, but there was clearly a reduction in the amount of hypotension, and there was a reduction in the amount of cramps. However, the intradialytic weight gain actually increased in patients on a sodium modeling protocol, and their pre-dialysis blood pressure, as predicted by that hemotrial data, was increased with the sodium modeling. So I don't think we should be pulling this out so quickly in our treatment of these patients. So the pros are that there is a modest decrease in the frequency of hypotension. It's easy to do. And the cons are, of course, thirst, intradialytic weight gain, and hypertension. How about cool dialysate? Well, the theory is reducing the core temperature causes peripheral vasoconstriction, thereby helps to maintain blood pressure by increasing peripheral vascular resistance and increasing cardiac filling. And the activation of the sympathetic nervous system has been implicated as being part of this response. And of course, we lower dialysate temperatures from roughly 37 to 35 degrees. Well, what does it do to cardiac hemodynamics? And this nice example of cool dialysis on hemodynamics, you can see that the cardiac output reduction was substantially reduced. The reduction was reduced. It was well better preserved than in those with control. And that core blood volume actually rose during dialysis as compared to those who were in control. Now, there are some concerns that I'll talk about in a few minutes, that if you constrict certain areas, you may not be perfusing them very well, and then you may not be removing urea and other accumulated uremic solutes, and thus you might get a little bit of that central recirculation problem. Let me go to the next slide. So, however, in an uncontrolled trial of 7,700 dialysis sessions, in terms of symptomatic hypotension, all patients, roughly 16%, cool dialysis, 14%. So there is a difference, but let's say that we're not going to write home about it in terms of its magnitude. However, of course, if you're a patient who is more prone to hypotension, this effect is more of a 20-25% effect. Now, of course, these patients complain that they are cold and they chill. How about pharmacologic agents? Well, we start with antihypertensive agents. And I'm not going to say to you that I have the answer in this regard, because clearly the wide range of agents that we use, some of them are shorter acting, some are longer acting. I know that, you know, in clinical practice, many of us will hold antihypertensive agents the morning of dialysis. But I have to tell you, there is very, very little data as to what the proper how much this maneuver changes the event rate of intradialytic hypotension, remarkably. But it's the first thing I think of course, in the patients who have persistently hypotension in the middle of dialysis. Now, other agents must be considered: caffeine, midodrine, carnitine. Let's talk about caffeine for a second. This trial came out in 1992, and what it was based on is that in some patients, prior to the initiation of a hypotensive event, you can see a dramatic increase in adenosine release. And this might be a manifestation of organ hypoperfusion and organ ischemia. And in this prospective trial, where they were given 250 milligrams of caffeine at 2 hours into hemodialysis, and that if you can see that the sudden hypotension over about a month was dropped maybe, you know, 40%. So, I mean, it raises an interesting possible simple solution. However, of course, I don't know about you, but how many requests have you guys had for Ambien, Sonata, and all that stuff? It might complicate other factors. How about midodrine? Well, midodrine's the new one on the block. It's an oral alpha-1 adrenergic agonist that will increase blood pressure by causing an increase in vascular tone in both venules and arterioles, thereby improving venous return as well as offsetting vasodilatory responses. Well, I'm only going to pull out one study because it kind of compares cool dialysate and midodrine in patients with intradialytic hypotension. And this was a well-conducted trial, randomized crossover, of control, midodrine, cool dialysate, or the combination of the two. And you can see that within the control group, there was more profound hypotension, but in the other groups, cool dialysate, midodrine, and the combination, there was an abatement of this hypotensive effect. However, there didn't seem to be either an additive or a synergistic effect of the two. When you look at the number of interventions, giving saline, putting them in Trendelenburg, this type of thing, control, there were 29 interventions, midodrine 7, cool dialysate 6, and the combination 8. It was clearly significantly different from control, but there was no distinction among the groups. Similarly, the amount of saline infused followed this exact same pattern, as did the symptoms. But, of course, as you would expect, in people who got cool dialysate, they complained of being cold fairly significantly. Let's now talk for a few minutes at the end about some promising new technologies. online blood pressure monitoring with modeling of ultrafiltration being individualized. And there are a variety of techniques, and you're going to have a parade in a few minutes to really go over these techniques. Well, we clearly know that over time, hematocrit increases as we do a standard dialysis treatment with steady ultrafiltration. Now, the question is, can this rise in hematocrit predict when a person is going to crash, right? And therefore, we can turn off the ultrafiltration and then come up to this critical level, turn it off, come up to this critical level, and never exceed the critical level, and therefore never have a hypotensive episode. Well, there have been a number of small studies, and I'm going to show you at least three or so that have given us some information in this regard. Okay, this is a one by John Dagirdis, and there are 9 hypotensive prone patients, and each of them were studied 6 times. This was done in the early 90s. Each patient did appear to have an, in quotes, crash crit. But the change of hematocrit for each treatment was relatively small. So in the initial average hematocrit was roughly 36%, and it rose to 40% and this crash crit was roughly 40%. So that's a 4.6% change. Within patient standard deviation for the crash crit was 2%, or roughly half of the distance. So therefore, it's going to be pretty hard to determine what the exact crash crit is. How about ultrafiltration profiling? This is a nice study that was conducted that had 188 sessions in 53 patients, and roughly 25% were hypotensive. Of these patients had hypotensive episodes. Now they compared 6 profiles using renal blood flow relative blood volume monitoring. Standard dialysis, where the ultrafiltration rate is continuous through the entire treatment. Slow descent, where essentially you have a slow descent in the ultrafiltration rate over the dialysis. And various forms of pulse therapy. I'm sorry, I'm drawing this out. Essentially pulse off at different frequencies. Now, what happened was that in terms of hypotension, in the standard or slow descent of the ultrafiltration rate, they were equivalent to each other, but when you had that off-on pulsing of ultrafiltration, there was actually about almost a 2-fold increase in the amount of hypotensive episodes. Not only were there a 2-fold increase in the hypotensive episodes, those patients felt worse, too. And yet these authors said of these 13, they could identify in 8 a threshold potential, right, above which 92% of the episodes occurred. Whereas 5, they had no relation to renal blood flow to hypotension. Now this always makes me very nervous when you take 13 patients and start describing 2 groups. It's just, where do you draw your lines? You know, this is prone to data manipulation. How about more sophisticated measures altogether? And I'm going to introduce the idea of biofeedback. Okay? The theory is that ultrafiltration induces peripheral vasoconstriction, which reduces perfusion of certain regions, thereby reducing solute clearance in those regions, such as the periphery. And this manifests itself by post-dialytic rebound in urea. Right? And it turns out that hypotension-prone patients do have a higher urea rebound and a lower equilibrated KT over V. So, the idea is that if you guide ultrafiltration carefully and you maybe incorporate variable sodium, I think I'm going to have to go up one. I missed one. Oh boy, now this is the problem. One second. Well, let me just go ahead because I'm missing one slide there. In this study, they took 12 hypotension-prone patients and they gave them standard treatment versus biofeedback. Now, this biofeedback assessed weight loss, which is what we always do, conductivity,
and the sodium concentration of the dialysate, and the change in blood volume. And then what it did was, through some very sophisticated software, it essentially took these three factors and described a best fit model whereby you would either change the conductivity, alter the weight loss, or get to your discerned goals of dialysis. And their endpoints were the number of hypotensive events and the change in urea kinetics. So essentially what we're doing is we're asking a computer program to do what a dialysis nurse does. Right? And of course, the computer program can do it automatically in a much quicker, it's prior to the onset of an event. So in the results, if you use this software model like this, that the amount of weight loss that these two groups was the same, the ultrafiltration rate was the same, not shown, but the number of hypotensive episodes, 59 of 72 treatments versus 24 over 72 treatments, was significantly lower. Now note that both the single pool and the equilibrated KTOV were substantially were substantially higher in the biofeedback group than they were in the standard group, suggesting that with this modeling type technique that we might not only lessen our tendency towards hypotension by making intradialytic adjustments that are sort of free fluid, we also might improve our overall dialysis dose. So I'd like to conclude by saying that hypertension is common in patients with renal disease and is a major contributor to cardiovascular disease. Hypertension is generally poorly controlled in dialysis patients. We must do better. Achieving an appropriate dry weight should control the blood pressure in the majority of patients. Target blood pressure should align with the JNC6 pending clinical trials, which are desperately needed. Intradialytic hypotension is usually triggered by overly rapid ultrafiltration. Efforts to overcome this potentially dangerous symptom include, 1, make some efforts to reduce the ultrafiltration rate by modifying the diet to decrease the weight gain, and perhaps in lengthening the dialysis treatment or doing more frequent dialysis. Sodium modeling, cool dialysate, midodrine, all may have a role in that very special patient that is having particular trouble. And then, of course, biofeedback is a possible frontier. So we must create strategies that take into account comorbid conditions. These patients are going to have heart disease, and the ones that are hypotension prone are more likely to have hypotension. And patient personalities, there are a lot of those in the dialysis unit. Hypertension management should be addressed monthly, and we should put it right up there with KTOV. We should be focusing on it more. Large clinical trials to determine blood pressure goals and to evaluate therapeutic strategies, especially these biofeedbacks, I think are urgently needed. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We have time for questions. And did you have one?
We're waiting for questions. One comment and then a question for Andy. The comment is that I think there's increasing concern about the effect of intradialytic sodium concentration on interdialytic blood pressure. And there are several abstracts that are presented, I believe several in plenary sessions over the course of the meeting to come over the next several days. So I think this is an issue that will get more attention in the future. A question for Andy while other people are developing questions. It is clear that we are, at least as we do dialysis in the U.S., we do need antihypertensive medications in the dialysis population. And I think it's also clear that there's no consensus on what agents to use or how to use them. One strategy I've always been attracted to has really been developed by Rajiv Agarwal, primarily at the University of Indiana, taking advantage of the pharmacology of drugs and their clear or lack of clearance in renal failure. And he sort of pioneered the approach of using antihypertensives that are renally cleared and giving a dose after each dialysis session with the idea that that you will achieve with a single dose over a 48-hour interval, intradialytic interval, relatively steady state antihypertensive efficacy, and then when patients come to dialysis, you'll dialyze out the antihypertensive and have less of an effect on intradialytic hypotension. And he's published data using both atenolol and lisinopril using that approach. Any comments on that strategy?
Well, of course, this just awaits the large clinical trial, honestly. The only thing I would comment on is that I think that as we look at the pre-dialysis data, we look at data in different populations, patients with cardiovascular disease, the HOPE trial and this type of thing, I think that I have been essentially putting every one of my patients on drugs that I think will lessen the tendency of cardiac hypertrophy. Now, of course, I'm making a leap of faith that the dialysis patient is going to behave the same way. But since 70 or 80% of the patients would fit the criteria of HOPE, or since 70 or 80% would fit the entry criteria of LIFE and other large clinical trials, I have been inclined to use more and more of the ACE inhibitors. As to the question regarding that strategy, I honestly must say that I have not been employing that strategy routinely. Perhaps others in the crowd have. Any other questions?